This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
United Nations aid agencies warn they have a two-month window of opportunity in drought-stricken Somalia in which to increase emergency assistance for millions of people and avert a catastrophe.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next. Also in Nigeria, the northeastern city of Maiduguri was attacked by as many as seven suicide bombers today. And protesters in South Africa have marched demanding restitution from a major bank for its apartheid-era profits. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, as many as seven suicide bombers, six of them women, tried to attack the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri today. AFP quotes the National Emergency Management Agency, NEMA, as saying there were no civilian casualties. Only the would-be bombers died. Some were killed when they blew themselves up, while others were shot by local defense forces. NEMA says the man who drove them to Maiduguri tried to ram a military checkpoint but failed. Police attributed earlier reports of multiple bombings to the sound of soldiers shelling suspected Boko Haram positions outside the city. United Nations aid agencies warn they have a two-month window of opportunity in drought-stricken Somalia in which to increase emergency assistance for millions of people and avert a catastrophe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations estimates half of Somalia's population, or 6.2 million people, are threatened by the drought which is spreading from the hard-hit northern regions. Over the past week, representatives of the World Food Programme and the UN Children's Fund visited some of the worst affected areas in the northern Puntland region. They describe scenes of utter devastation where people have reached the limit of their abilities to cope. WFP Country Director Laurent Bouquera says in one village, about 500 women and children were living precariously in makeshift huts, surrounded by dead livestock. He says the men had left the village in search of grazing land and water for the cattle that were still alive. Speaking on a telephone line from Nairobi, Bouquera told VOA, "There is a short window of opportunity in which aid agencies can increase emergency operations and prevent the worst from happening."
The severity, the spread of the drought and of the situation this time around is bigger, is larger geographically than what happened in 2010-11. Therefore, if we don't respond fast enough, if we don't respond at scale, yes, we can prepare ourselves for a catastrophe which is at least to the size and the intensity of the situation we experienced over there in 2010-11.
Nearly 260,000 people, half of them children under five, died during the famine in Somalia between 2010 and 2012. UNICEF projects the number of severely malnourished children in Somalia could reach 270,000 over the coming months. Although the situation is extremely grave, WFP's Bukera says Somalia has a better chance of averting a catastrophe this time around. He says the international community has been alerted to the crisis for some time and has begun responding earlier to this emergency than to the last. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters in South Africa marched today demanding restitution from a major bank for its apartheid-era profits. It's part of a growing movement to address deep racial imbalances. The movement calls for land to be forcibly redistributed to disenfranchised black South Africans. President Jacob Zuma has indicated through proposed legislation he may be prepared to do just that.
A small protest for a movement that has captured the attention of South Africa's most powerful players. Some 200 activists from the far-left Black First, Land First movement gathered wearing Land or Death t-shirts and sang protest songs seeking restitution for apartheid-era profits from a major South African bank. But as their name indicates, this pressure group has its sights set on something far bigger. They want land to be given to Black South Africans as compensation for colonial-era land seizures. And they're not the only ones seeking to rebalance the scale. Also on Friday, President Jacob Zuma referred a bill back to Parliament that seeks to redress racial imbalances in land ownership. Lindsay Masdorp, national spokesman for Black First, Land First, says the government's efforts are insufficient. His group objects to the current policy that allows landowners to hold out until the selling price is acceptable. He says Zuma's constitutionally based approach is also not enough.
We're saying Black people should be buying back stolen land. We agree that we should not. White people didn't come here and just start speaking to us and say, hey, let me take it. It was a violent process and it continues to be a violent process. When we confront violence, we will do so with violence too. Sometimes it will be with words, sometimes it will be through dialogue, but other times it will be physical as well.
In recent years, anger over land inequality has been accompanied by violence against owners of farms and small holdings. South African police typically report about 500 incidents each year. Unemployed 45-year-old protester Simon Kufelo says his lack of land affects him deeply.
When talking about the debate of land, I become too emotional because at this present, we shouldn't have been talking about this. I mean, we have made about 23 years in democracy and then there's nothing that is happening with the land distribution. 80% is still whites having 80% of land, and we, the majority, we are having 20%. I think if they can make sure that they are no more going on the snail pace, but try to pick up and move faster like a Ferrari, I think.
That 80% statistic has been thoroughly debunked by government land surveys. A recent private survey looking at residential property says Black South Africans own 52% of the value of the nation's homes, and that figure is rising. However, nearly 80% of South Africa's population is Black, meaning they are still underrepresented in this domain. This imbalance clearly preoccupies President Jacob Zuma, who spent about 15 minutes of his recent 90-minute address to the nation talking about radical economic transformation, a plan to use government programs and resources to encourage more economic participation by Black South Africans.
The skewed nature of ownership and leadership patterns needs to be corrected. There can be no sustainability in any economy if the majority is excluded in this manner.
But, says Associate Professor of Economics Christopher Malikane of the University of the Witwatersrand, Zuma's ambitious plans may be just political maneuvering. Analysts say Zuma's growing unpopularity led the long-ruling African National Congress to lose ground in last year's local elections. As a result, the party is now divided and scrambling to gain support ahead of crucial national elections in 2019. This radical economic transformation, Malikane says, may be a casualty of the current rift in the ruling party.
And it is the struggle between these two factions, basically within the ANC, that is going to lead the ANC not to coherently implement what the president is talking about, because his faction itself is not 100% in control of the ANC.
But many protesters on Friday said they have little interest in watching this complex debate go through the political and legislative motions. They want land, they say, and they want it now. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
More violence early this morning at the Spanish enclave of Ceuta on the Moroccan border. Sub-Saharan African migrants again stormed the fences with tools and bats. Many broke through, but injuries are reported among migrants and police. There are frequent break-in attempts because migrants view the territory as a gateway into Europe. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments on Ceuta and other migrant-related news. From Rome, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Hundreds of migrants smashed their way into Spain's North African territory of Ceuta from Morocco early on Friday. They clashed with some police. The numbers could be around 300 to 500 people. There's also video available on the web where we see the migrants actually jubilant for having made it through, yelling out, Viva la España, long live Spain, and big smiles and lots of excitement. But they did clash. There were three police from the Civil Guard of Spain and two migrants injured and taken to hospital. And around 30 migrants were being treated for broken bones, according to some media reports. And on the other side of the frontier, there were 10 Moroccan armed forces also injured as there was this surge of migrants from North Africa into the Spanish territory.
Now, obviously, the migrants are happy to be there, but is there any guarantee that they will be allowed to stay and then move on to Spain and other parts of Europe?
It seems that they have been cordoned off to some degree, and it's not clear whether they're actually all in the same area or some have actually escaped already. But you may recall the last attempt that took place on New Year's Day when more than 1,000 migrants tried to jump this double fence that separates Morocco and Ceuta, and one officer at that time lost an eye. So they're desperate to get into Spain as they are into Italy and other parts of Europe, and there's no sign of this slowing down in the future.
I'm sure we'll be talking about Ceuta again, but let me ask you about a possible deal between Italy and Tunisia regarding rescued migrants. Would you tell us about that?
We had a report in one of the Italian daily newspapers today saying that Italy is close to reaching an agreement with Tunisia on accepting migrants who have left from Libya and picked up in international waters by Italian and European rescue teams. Under this arrangement, the Tunisian government would obtain financial support and other support from Italy and the EU in exchange for accepting refugees that have been rescued. Now, the Italians wanted to propose 1,000 migrants per month, but Tunisia only wants to accept 200 a month. In exchange for that, Italy and the EU want to give the Tunisian government financial support, step up their security, and perhaps share greater intelligence regarding terrorism and other issues. This is also being talked about as a model for other countries across North Africa.
Now, Pope Francis is also speaking out on the migrant crisis today. What does he have to say about the ongoing influx?
Well, Pope Francis, as we know, feels very strongly about social justice. He's spoken out many times in support of migrants and refugees. Today, he made some very strong comments, once again noting that the Mediterranean Sea is a cemetery, what he calls a cemetery. And he also accused developed countries of being very much to blame for the war, the famine, the poverty, the joblessness that forces so many people to leave their home countries and make that journey to Europe in search of a better life. His challenge is for many of us to embrace difference and diversity and celebrate that, to support our neighbours, to welcome our neighbours, no matter where they come from.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. United Nations aid agencies are trying to step up efforts to increase emergency assistance to drought-stricken Somalia to avert a catastrophe. In Nigeria, the northeastern city of Maiduguri was attacked by as many as 7 suicide bombers today. And protesters in South Africa marched today demanding restitution from a major bank for its apartheid-era profits. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The successful development of a malaria vaccine just got 2 steps closer two vaccine candidates have been shown to be effective. In one case, 100% effective in preventing the mosquito-borne disease. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The two vaccines were developed by the biotech firm Cenaria Incorporated of Rockville, Maryland. They prime the immune system against the malaria parasite by introducing live weakened sporozoites, the earliest spore stage of the parasite injected into the body by infected mosquitoes, beginning the cycle of disease. Both vaccines target Plasmodium falciparum, the most common and deadly form of the disease. In the most successful of the two trials carried out in Germany, varying doses of the live attenuated vaccine, weakened by a chemotherapy agent, were injected into 27 healthy volunteers, while another group of 15 was given a placebo. The participants were then exposed to P. falciparum parasites between 8 and 10 weeks after the last vaccine dose. Stephen Hoffman is chief executive and scientific officer of Cenaria. The surprising results, he says, were seen in 9 of the participants who received the highest vaccine dose.
We got 100% protection against malaria at 10 weeks, 2.5 months after the last dose of vaccine. That is really beginning to look like something quite extraordinary, and that's never been done before.
A second trial involving another whole sporozoite vaccine, weakened by radiation, was carried out in Mali. It tested whether the vaccine prevented reinfection among people who'd already been exposed to malaria. In that study, 66% of those in the treatment group became reinfected with malaria within 6 months after they were vaccinated, compared to 93% of participants in the placebo group. While far from ideal, Hoffman calls the results a good first step.
This is the highest level of efficacy against malaria infection ever seen in a vaccine trial in Africa.
Hoffman thinks Cenaria's vaccines show more promise than others because they use the entire sporozoite to ramp up the immune system. He says other vaccines use only a few P. falciparum proteins out of some 5,000 to try to get a good immune response against the malaria parasite, which he believes is a less effective strategy. He says more clinical trials are planned of both vaccines throughout Africa, including Mali, Burkina Faso, Kenya, Equatorial Guinea, and Tanzania.
For us, our raison d'etre for Cenaria is to develop a vaccine that could be used in what we call mass vaccination campaigns to immunize the entire population in a geographically defined area so that one could halt transmission and eliminate the parasite.
Malaria is a leading global killer, especially among children in sub-Saharan Africa. The World Health Organization estimates there are 214 million cases of malaria each year and 438,000 deaths worldwide. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Six years ago, the Arab Spring arrived in Libya and began with peaceful demonstrations in Benghazi. But then leader Muammar Gaddafi responded with lethal force, triggering a war that led to his downfall after 42 years in power. Much political turmoil has ensued with rival individuals and governing bodies, including the UN-backed Government of National Accord, or GNA. This week, Egypt's chief of staff, Lieutenant General Mahmoud Hagazi, mediated between the head of the GNA, Faiz Sarraj, and Khalifa Haftar, the country's powerful army commander. They agreed to form a committee to renegotiate a UN peace deal. Former Egyptian ambassador to Libya, Hani Khalaf, spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about whether any changes should be made to make the deal work.
The additions that could be thought of or changes, ameliorations that could be done in the Suhairat deal would relate directly to the relationship between the Libyan armed forces headed by Khalifa Haftar and its relations with the parliament or with the national consultation government headed by Faiz Sarraj. This problem seems to be ironic because Faiz Sarraj people would care very much to have the commandment of the armed forces in Libya under their control, while the widely recognized parliament of Tobruk insists on having this commandment under his own control. Khalifa Haftar tends to believe that he is easier to work with the parliament and not with the government of Tripoli. This is the problem, and we have to face it. Maybe some work should be done closely with the various rivals in Libya to solve this problem.
How about the so-called Salvation Government in Tripoli?
No, this is not recognized there anymore. This has been replaced by the National Conciliation Government headed by Faisal Sarraj and endorsed in the Sukhairat deal. The other problem facing the whole Libyan parties lie within the fact that even the parties in the western part of Libya are still conflicting with each other. The people of Misrata, some organizations in Zawiya city and in Tarhuna, are still challenging the authority of the conciliation government of Faisal Sarraj. Though they seem to be taking one side against Khalifa Haftar and the people in the east, but from within, they have some differences and different approaches.
So, if one of the changes was to include General Haftar as the army commander, what would that mean for Haftar's ambition?
The problem is whether he is ready to receive political guidance from the parliament or from the head of the government. Normally, at any other state, any military body should follow the political guidance given by the chief of the state, who is now Faisal Sarraj.
According to the agreement, once the parliament based in eastern Libya endorses the changes, it would pave the way for parliamentary and presidential elections next year. Would that work?
Yes, if both parties execute sincerely and exactly what has been agreed upon in Cairo, I think the other step would be to wait for the parliamentary elections and presidential election and the additions to the constitution, the changes that should be made into the constitution declaration. So we are hoping that all parties would stick to what has been reached in Cairo.
Would the Egyptian mediation replace the UN role in Libya?
I don't think so. The Egyptian role is helping the UN to bridge gaps between the very many rivals in Libya. It should not be called exclusive Egyptian mediation because some of its movements and segments are shared by other neighboring countries to Libya, namely Tunisia and Algeria. I think we share with them some concerns, particularly that related to fighting terrorism and terrorist movements. And secondly, the securing of the borders. But when we come to the real political differences within the political system, I think Egypt is far ahead with some substantive points that is suggesting for the rivals here in Cairo.
Hani Khalaf is the former Egyptian ambassador to Libya. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wycheck Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC.
and our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.